probably one of my favorite parts of the show. Playing a little air drum right now. Love it. It's the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Inside. How are you feeling on a Thursday morning? Beautiful, right? Well, we had a little break, a little reprieve here in New York City in the Big Apple, the sweltering apple. But now it's back with a vengeance. Now until Monday, 95 degrees, 97, 100, three digits. No! Go down in the subway, you come out looking like you just showered with your clothes on. Got a great show coming your way. And by the way, thank you so much for your emails about last week's show with Will Lockenauer, the Paralympian headed to Rio. Go, Will! Hand crank cyclist. Awesome guy. Good dude. You're going to have him back. And as a matter of fact, every week leading up until Rio Paralympics, we're going to have another athlete on. We had one scheduled for today, but unfortunately, they had a change in their training schedule. So when you're an elite Olympic athlete, and they call me up and they're like, Mark, is there any way we can reschedule? I said, sure, absolutely. Because if they don't podium, they could say, I blame it on Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network. And I wouldn't want that on my conscience. Would you? I mean, you're our listeners. I mean, you have a say in this. So you wouldn't want it weighing on your conscience, would you? So listen, there's a new book out. It's a great book. It's called The Poverty Industry. And it basically tears apart how money is distributed improperly in the United States, affecting foster children, the disabled, the elderly, and so much more. That author is coming on in a few minutes. But of course, in the, this just kind of brings my mood down. So we're going to keep it positive. In light of all the shootings lately, of course, what happened in Dallas, that it's something I've wanted to discuss. As a matter of fact, I had something else planned for today. There was a great dissertation that I want to share with you. Not going to be today, and I don't want the word dissertation to scare you. Be like, I'm running for the hills. He's not going to read me War and Peace, is he? No. A great friend of mine who's Indian responded to something that he saw online, and he read it to me and shared it with me, and I thought it was just phenomenal about his experience of being treated improperly with prejudice, etc. And it rings true for a lot of people in this world. As a matter of fact, a little sidebar here, my wife is Indian. She's born in New Jersey, and she actually looks like whatever kind of circle she's in. If she's in with a bunch of Mexican people, she looks Mexican. If she's in with a bunch of Italians, she looks Italian. But she's Indian. And her parents are kind of getting up there in age. And so we're trying to get them to consider moving to a new neighborhood. And they live in a very nice neighborhood right now for probably 35 years, 40 years. But unfortunately, this is a sad part, is that they're really concerned about moving to a new neighborhood, even to a senior neighborhood, a retirement community where it's usually 55 and above, you know, where no keg parties are happening, or no sorority parties. But my father-in-law, my wife's father wears a turban. So it's a real shame that in this day and age, in 2016, with a gentleman who's 80 years old has to be concerned about wearing his turban, which basically they wear turbans because the Sikh Indians wear turbans because their hair is so long, because they're such a modest person, people, religion, that they don't believe in cutting their hair. So that's why he wears it up in a turban. Otherwise, it'd be halfway down his back. So that's the reason why they wear turbans, just to keep it cleaner and so it doesn't look as disheveled, etc. So it's unfortunate that, you know, in this day and age, and of course we're learning more and more about this because I thought we had evolved a little bit more in the last 20 years with racism. But it still exists, and it's across a lot of boundaries. So of course, with the last couple of weeks passing by, all the events that unfolded, tragic events, you know, it's just a whirlwind of turmoil. The country is in such a tumultuous state that it really saddens me. And the worst part about it for me, because usually I can, you know, wrap my head around it and say, okay, well, I know the issue, I know the problem, but what kind of resolution is there? That's the thing. We need a resolve here. And I'm sure Donald Trump's wife, you know, has these a speech written for this that she's going to unveil for us any day. What's her name? Milana or something like that? wink, wink. But in reality is that's their deal. So the other day, it came across me. I was on Facebook, and I read about this guy named Andrew Fox. He's 21 years old, lives in South Jersey, and he's really astute, African-American man, very articulate, handsome, and he works at a radio station actually in Philadelphia, WMMR, phenomenal radio station. I was listening to MMR when I was probably 12 years old, and I'm probably a great deal older than Andre, but it's a great station. And after the shootings, he was driving home from the radio station in Dallas, and he was just so, well, we're going to hear from him what he felt exactly. But so he started a movement that we're going to share with you momentarily, but I wanted to share it with you because, number one, it's a great viral way to start dialogue between police and the community, whether you're African-American, Indian, Caucasian, whatever your ethnic background is. It's really important. And what really, really pleased me even more so that Andre Fox started this movement, hashtag PICS4Peace, and that's the number, the letter F-O-R, PICS, P-I-C-S, F-O-R, Peace, is that people are submitting pictures all across the nation, and it's really going viral, and the police are really gravitating towards it. So without any further ado, Andre, welcome to the show, my friend.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right. How's the weather in South Jersey today?
It's actually phenomenal. Not too hot, not too cold. I'm so upset that we couldn't make it into the city, though.
Hey, listen, there's always another date, my friend. As a matter of fact, if this keeps gaining momentum, we're going to have you in here for a longer dialogue. We did have a cancellation today, if you may have heard a few moments ago, so we were happy to fit you in here because I'm really, really stoked about this movement that you created, hashtag Picks for Peace, on the way home. So tell me about the inception of this.
Okay, so after everything that happened, I was just like, all right, like I was really upset about it because, of course, being an African-American man, like you can never feel safe after something like that happens. And then the retaliation killings happening, I'm just like, how can I flip this? Because we've been lucky enough not to have this problem where I'm from, Sickleville, New Jersey. We haven't had any police brutality problems. So I haven't had to personally deal with this. And I'm like, all right, well, if you look online, all the comments from people are talking about, oh, there's a war coming and this is happening and this is going to happen and it's going to be police versus blacks and white versus blacks. And I was like, how can I flip this before it gets to my community? So I hit up my two friends, Aaron and Nigel, and I was like, all right, you know what? Let's go down to the police station. They were like, what for? Aaron didn't even want to go. He was like, it's my only day off. I just want to play basketball. And I was like, well, there's things more important than basketball. So we went, and I just went up there to the police station, and I was like, hey, you know, let's just have this talk real quick. And
okay,
that's exactly
Andre,
what happened.
I got to interrupt you here because, you know, you really just don't stroll into a police station and kind of request to speak with somebody, you know, with a badge. So what exactly did you say?
We walked in, and it's three black guys walking in. I'm a big black guy, so.
It sounds
like
the beginning of a joke. Three black guys walk into a police station.
Yeah, right? It's like some crazy joke. And the first thing I said was, look, we're not here to confess to anything. We don't have any weapons on us. We're not here to confess to a crime. We just want to talk to a police officer. And she was like, all right, is there anybody specifically? And I was like, can we actually talk to the chief or anybody of importance? And she was like, well, we can't get you guys the chief. So what a regular officer do? And we were like, sure. So we waited about 20 minutes, and then this huge, tall guy comes out, and he's like 7 foot Shaq. And we're like, all right, cool. He's like, come back here. So we walk back there, and we walk into this room. And we're like, all right, well, we're not here to confess to anything. Like, we didn't do anything, this, that, and the third. And he's like, well, I hope you didn't, because I'm actually the chief of Winslow Township.
Wow.
And we were like, oh, okay. And he was like, yeah, and this is my room. So he was like, this is my office. I hope you didn't do anything because we don't have anything to, like, lock you up with back here. So we were just like, okay, we want to talk about what's been going on and what happened over the weekend. And this was the weekend of the Dallas shooting. So he literally went on for about an hour and a half or 2 hours telling us how they plan to help the situation with police brutality, going from everything from, like, better traffic stops to body cameras and going to community events. And at the end of it, he was like, all right, well, what do you guys want to do? Or he was like, did you come in here with an idea? And we had, like, no idea. So he gave us his personal number. He was like, call me on Monday, and we'll figure something out. So we were like, all right. And I was like, right before we left, I was like, hey, can we grab a picture real quick? So we grabbed the picture, and it was like we were all leaving. Everything was cool. And I was like, how can we, like, let's post this picture with, like, a movement. Let's start a movement.
Sure.
And we saw the Picks for Police But we were like, that's a little bit like, that's keeping it to just like the black community mm-hmm. and the police officers. Because everybody's talking about there's a war coming. So war doesn't choose its victim. Nobody gets to decide who dies in war. So it hits everybody. So we were like, let's make this for everybody and let's do picks for peace. That way, it's a simple thing, honestly. You just walk up to somebody of a different race than yours, or a police officer of a different race than yours, and police officers are supposed to do this too, and they have been, and you grab a picture with them and post a hashtag picks for peace. But the catch is, it's not something as simple as, like, all right, just taking a picture and bye. Nobody just takes a picture of a random person and doesn't talk to them. You have to have a conversation. And that conversation could lead to a great friendship or even a best friendship. Like, me and Chief have been talking every day since two Fridays ago when we started this.
It's so phenomenal to see Andre on many, many levels. Number one, that they've let you basically walk into their office without saying, okay, I'm sorry you don't have an appointment. Can you submit a document or a request for an appointment and tell us what the topic's going to be about, et cetera. We'll get back to you. Next thing you know, a month goes by, et cetera, et cetera. So it's great that they open their doors. And then, of course, this is such a hotbed topic that he was so willing. As a matter of fact, I think it was very – I can't speak on behalf of the captain, but I imagine with the length of time that he spent with you, he was looking for an outlet too.
Oh, for sure. He was extremely passionate about it. We honestly thought, like you said, that we were going to get blown off as soon as we walked in. They were going to be like, look, you don't have an appointment, or we just can't let anybody see a chief or anything like that. We thought they were just going to send us on our way. But he honestly took the time. He was insanely passionate about it.
And what race is the police captain?
He's Caucasian.
Caucasian. How old, approximately?
I think his birthday was yesterday. Yeah, his birthday was yesterday. I think he's going to kill me if I get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure he's 47 now.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to kill you because then he'd have to lock himself up.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, he can't do that. Yeah. So
I mean, he could, but, I doubt it. That really wouldn't help the cause, would it? But it would make for an interesting Pigs for Peace picture, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. What? Me getting strangled by the police chief? Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, that would be good. Definitely go viral, right, my friend?
Oh, that'd be something. Yeah, viral. Maybe we get a hashtag started. Oh, yeah.
So how did you convince your friends, because you didn't have a plan on the way over there, to join you in something that was, for all intents and purposes, kind of a wild goose chase?
Well, I mean, my one friend, Nigel, he didn't take a lot of convincing. Usually, because we work together on a lot of stuff and a lot of charity events, so usually when I come up with an idea, he's just like, all right, word, let's do it. But Aaron is completely the opposite. He was just like, no, it's going to be stupid. They're going to send us out. They're gonna just act like this isn't a huge thing or whatever. And I was like, well, they can't really. It's not a situation that they can, like, neglect. They can't afford to say, no, we're not going to talk about this. This is a huge situation. So after I actually sat down with Aaron and explained to him everything that was going on and what I wanted to do, he was like, all right. He came around to it. And he was like, all right, this is probably the best idea you've ever had. So we went in and we did the thing.
And you're referring to your partners, Nigel Newman and Aaron Grant, also members of the hashtag Picks for Peace, the word FORPEACE, which has gone viral.
Indeed.
Speaking to Andre Fox, who's 21 years of age, who's living in South Jersey right now. So tell me, what kind of town do you live in? Do you live in a very mixed community, or is it very homogenous?
It's pretty mixed. Yeah, it's pretty mixed. We have... See, the crazy thing about it is it's so mixed that we have, like, all kinds of churches, Methodist, Baptist, and we even have a mosque there in town.
That's
I didn't even
great.
Know about until we talked to the chief. But I had no clue until we talked to the chief. But it's really, because there's different parts of it. There's different parts where it's, like, majority black, and then there's, like, parts that are majority white. And then there's a good part that's, like, a good portion of it is, like, mixed, like, all races. So that's pretty amazing to be able to see all the different cultures while we're walking around. You can just walk around town and see a bunch of different people. It's amazing.
So did you, yourself, and your friends, Aaron and Nigel, and anyone else in your, your cash buddies or family members, how did you feel the reverberations of everything that's been happening during the last year in terms of blacks getting shot inadvertently or purposefully by police?
Well, it's because I never want to make it seem like I'm strictly on one side, because I like to see both sides of the problem here. And it's like, it's a lot worse because now there's cameras. There's like before you would just hear stories like, oh, this African-American man was gunned down, or this unarmed man was shot. You'd hear stories of it. But now there's cameras, and everybody has a camera in their hand. Everybody has a news outlet in their hand or in their pocket that they can pull out and just start recording, and bam, now everybody knows about it. So it's a lot more different now that you're seeing it. You're seeing them get killed. You're seeing African-American unarmed men get shot and killed. So it's a lot, like, you can't just say, oh, well, they could have had a gun on them now, because you're seeing that their hands are behind their back or anything like that, and they're still getting shot. There's no excuse for it now. Before, you could make an excuse and be like, oh, well, it only happened because they did this, or it only happened because they did that. But now you see actual proof that, like, okay, he was on the ground, his hands are behind his back. Why did he get shot? And that becomes it's a lot crazier now that you can see it.
It's almost like the jury's spoken already. But unfortunately, you know, we do see video and have audio sometimes, but we don't see the entire piece. And a lot of times, as we know from history, that sometimes what happened preceded before that or precipitated the event, et cetera. So the reality is it's happening. We need to kind of bridge the gap between police officers and the community. And I think
this is
a great organic way because I think police organizations know what to do, but I think they are very, very cautious about making things worse before they get better. But having the community reach out, okay, granted, now let's be realistic here. You live in a very, very safe southern New Jersey town. It's not an urban city. It's not Newark, New Jersey. It's not Camden. It's not Chicago, where 60 people get shot during the 4th of July weekend. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, Kublai Khan
there. It's just regular. I think we've had one shooting in the last 15 years. We've actually only had one cop that was killed in the line of duty, and that was in 1994, I believe.
So it's pretty much a safe town. But the reality is,
for all intents and purposes, it's a safe town.
Here's the reality. I am a 47-year-old white guy, tall guy, went to school with blacks, Spanish people, all makes of life, especially in college as well. And I think that really, really helps people with their perception. Being worldly opens their eyes and makes them realize that everyone is the same. People are good people. People are bad people. People, you know, through the beat of a different drum, et cetera. And so I always think to myself that I don't live in a bubble, but sometimes my realist gets a little bit clouded because I think the two coasts are very, very liberal, like New York City, the Five Boroughs, New Jersey, Connecticut, et cetera. But racism is still alive and kicking, especially there's not too far from where I live, and I'm embarrassed to say this, up to a few years ago, KKK is still present in central New Jersey.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And when I hear of shootings happen like this, that just makes me, it really sickens. My wife and I look at each other like, this is just incredible. I can't believe this is the world we live in nowadays. You know, one of the more civilized nations on this planet called Earth in 2016, and this is what we're dealing with.
Exactly. So how's it going to be in, like, 2021? How's that going to be then?
You went to college. What did you study, Andre?
I studied radio and TV broadcast at CSB.
You are damned. You are doomed for failure.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I've been in radio, obviously, for over 20 years, so that's why I'm busting your chops. But now this is a great platform for you because you're a well-spoken, articulate, bright kid, 21 years of age. You have the world at your fingertips, disposal. Professionally, you could be, along with your friends possibly, I'm not sure what their career paths entail, Aaron and Nigel, but if not just you yourself, you can spearhead a movement like this and get into radio, have a talk show, create the conversation, whether it's something that you solely want to focus on or not, but you can make a difference because, as you realize, hashtag Picks for Peace has gone, what are you up to, about 2,000 shares?
I have no clue. I haven't even checked the post. But, like, it's been, like, I think it's 2,000 shares. I know it's the news station that covered it, Fox News here in Philly. They're up to, like, tens of thousands, and we're getting pictures literally nonstop every day sent to us at our Facebook page, Picks for Peace, and it's going nuts.
You've been
completely insane.
You've been featured on Philadelphia radio stations, Philadelphia TV stations, and there's a reason for this. because it's so simple, but yet so complex. Because
exactly,
it
everybody thinks it's just like, okay, I'm going to go take a picture. But everybody who went in with that mindset, like, all right, just take a picture. I've never seen anybody just post something and say, pics for peace. It's always like, pics for peace with my new best friend or with my new friend. And they'll actually have a name up there, like my new best friend John or my new friend John. They'll say their name, which lets me know that they actually talked to them and had a conversation.
And now I guess we should confirm with our listeners that it's not only black people or people of other ethnic backgrounds that can take a picture with a police officer. It's anybody.
It's anyone. Not only black people, not only white people, not only black cops, not only white cops, everybody, every race, as long as they are a different race than yours. So if you see, and if you're white and you see an Indian guy walking around, just, hey, what's up? You want to, have you heard about this challenge? You want to take this picture real quick? Anything. Or a police officer. And police officers definitely do it too as well. And they have been doing it, which is awesome when I see police officers sending me their pictures with other people.
And finally, Andre, we're running short on time, but I want to get your perspective on Black Lives Matter.
That's a tough one, because at the same time, it's like, it depends on which one you're talking about, because there's different types of Black Lives Matter people. You have the people who are like radicals, and they're like, oh, we have to go to war and we have to fight back. And you had the peaceful people who are protesting. And I support protesting, just peaceful protesting. I don't support going out and hitting people, spitting on people, fighting people. I don't support any of that. But to me, it's just like, it's a very iffy line. You have to walk a fine line. If you're going to say Black Lives Matter, you have to walk a fine line. And at the same time, I feel like a lot of people don't understand what Black Lives Matter really means. It's not saying that no lives matter. It's just saying this is like, we're being slaughtered on camera. Focus on this for right now so we can fix this, and then cool. But it's not, I think a lot of people take it out of context and they're like, oh, because they're saying Black Lives Matter, it's the only thing that matters. When it's not, every life matters. When they say all life matters, yes, that's true. But right now, the situation that we're dealing with is unarmed black men being killed by police officers with power for no good reason. And we can see it now.
Have you ever been pulled over by an officer?
I've been pulled over by an officer multiple times.
Do you feel, believe me, join the club. Do you feel that your experience as a black man of 21 years of age, and maybe this is younger when it happened, that you were more fearful when those lights were blinking behind you and you're waiting for those, whatever, 30 seconds or so for the officer to walk up to your car?
I think when I'm getting pulled over, the only time that I'll feel like up in arms is when I see another black man killed on TV. For nothing at all. And I'm like, okay, like the only time that I'll feel afraid, and I'll still feel like this, is when it's like early in the morning and it's still dark out, or it's late at night and it's dark out and there's no one else on the road and it's just me and that officer. I'll feel some type of way, like, all right, could this be it? But I know that the officer at the same time, seeing all these cops getting killed, now he's thinking, could this be it? So we're both going in on edge to this stop that's supposed to be a regular traffic stop. We're both going in thinking, this could be it. And that's not a good mentality to have.
No, I mean, the reality is it's a very dangerous job. I mean, no matter where you are in the country or in the world, when you pull somebody over, you're susceptible because you're walking up to an environment that you have no idea what's inside this cabin of a car or a cockpit or a truck or whatever the case may be. So they feel very vulnerable, and understandably, but they are trained or highly trained, like state troopers. They are trained to feel like they're an army of one. And that personality comes across because they carry that confidence. But
yeah.
At the same time, I think they're sometimes better trained, and I don't have the answers. I'm just throwing this out there. I don't know if this is – I think it's a confluence of events that have to happen. The community and the police organizations collectively have to come together, whether it's community, state by state. I think the federal government needs to allocate more money for programs. I think school programs need to be instituted where police come into the schools. As a matter of fact, I speak at schools nationally, and about 6 months ago I attended a school, and there was a full-time police lieutenant. That office is not at the police office, the police precinct. It's actually in the school. And I was really, really impressed by this because he goes, okay, yes, sometimes it's a little bit hairy because I need to get my work done. But at the same time, my door, see this door, Mark? It's always open. Kids stop in. And they talk to me and tell me about the problems. He gets the pulse of what's going on in the hallways in school, what's going on in the streets in the community. So I think it's invaluable. And it's also not because it's a not safe school, but they're doing it more so to keep the trouble out in terms of, mass shootings, et cetera. not race issues.
Definitely.
But at the same time, that concept could possibly work. Not so much it could be a tool, dual prong, because of security and also bridging the gap and creating the understanding that police officers are people too. Police officers have to understand that if you're a 15-year-old, 20-year-old, or a 30-year-old African-American male, you know, what it's like to walk a mile in their shoes. Hey,
exactly.
And I'm not saying everybody's good. It doesn't matter what color or race you are. There are people who are just dirtbags in this world.
Yeah, honestly, and that's one of the biggest things that's behind this. It's like, it's trying to, like, it's not just about taking a picture. You're trying to get everyone to, like, understand. And as long as everybody, you were stating how this could be fixed, but I think that's one of the, like, main solutions of this is to literally just try to understand everyone else around you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't just understand yourself and your own racist struggle, because if I were to do that, then I wouldn't understand the struggle of a Caucasian man, because there are struggles that Caucasian people go through, there are struggles that Indian people go through, there are struggles that Spanish people go through. Everybody goes through struggle, so if you can try to understand everyone's struggle, then this world will be a much better place.
It's almost like if you can grab, you know, 50 kids from the Bronx, or I'm just throwing out an area, and take them to a police training facility and replicate, like, a dark scene on a highway and say, here's what you're going to do. You're a police officer, and they give them a quick training, whatever. Now you're going to walk up to that car so they understand what it feels like. And then you take the police officers, you throw them into whatever urban environment or in Texas or wherever the case may be and say, okay, now you're walking down a street, and a cop pulls up to you, a white cop or whatever the case may be, role reversal, and how would you feel? And this is how they feel, susceptible, vulnerable, and maybe they're guilty, maybe they're not. But, I mean, it could be a first step. This is going to take years to correct, and I don't know if Donald Trump certainly has the answer. I don't know if Hillary Clinton has the answer. But hopefully, collectively, I think it's up to you, me, everyone listening.
Sure. It's up to everybody.
And I think the hatred on social media certainly has to come to an end. And people who post things that are malicious and nefarious need to be put in place as well in a very stylized, not the sword, where they say the expression is the pen is muddier than a sword. But one step at a time, you know, one statement, one typing, one relationship, and one picture. And it's hashtag Picks for Peace. And that's Andre Fox. You're the man. I really appreciate your time. Congratulations to you, to Aaron Grant, Nigel Newman. And keep us posted and keep up the great work, man. Keep the conversation going.
Oh, we will do. Thank you so much for having us. We're going to have to definitely try to get in there next time in the city.
We will definitely link up, my friend.
Awesome.
Insight on PRN will return momentarily right after this.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
This is Coldplay live from the other night, Giant Stadium. Unbelievable show. Chris Martin, 60,000 people. Phenomenal show the other night, and I wanted to tell you something pretty cool. They shared, when you walked in, you got a wristband. Everybody got a wristband. It was white, pretty nondescript, and they told me it was going to light up. I'm like, okay, cool, whatever. I put it on my arm, and as the show started, all 60,000 people or so, all their wristbands went off. And soon, throughout the show, they would come in different colors. They would have different pulsations in different times, and it was really, really neat. So instead of holding up your lighter or your cell phone, it would actually just go to the beat of the music, and it was really kind of clever. And of course, you kind of put it back in the return bucket or trash can or whatever when you're walking out, because they recycle them for the next event. So it was really cool, a very, very creative kind of imagined way to make listeners or concertgoers feel really connected. So great show. Coldplay the other day. And I want to introduce my next guest. Daniel Hatcher is an incredible writer. He's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He previously worked at the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau and Children's Defense Fund. He was Representative Foster Children and Impoverished Adults, testified before Congress and the Maryland General Assembly, and written widely about poverty and fiscal abuse. His new book is called The Poverty Industry, and it really brings to light what actually is happening. I can't say disconnect, because they're really plugged in. What's happening between critical funds for the elderly, disabled, foster kids, and more. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. So obviously you had more than much of an impetus to write this book because of all your vast experience dealing with all the vital components that you write about.
Well, thank you. Much of it does come from my past work with low-income clients, and in particular foster children. My first legal aid job almost 20 years ago was representing children in the Baltimore foster care system, and then it was overwhelming to see what kids were going through, both in care and as they were struggling to leave care.
And we've all kind of heard, of course, about the mistreatment and or families who are the foster parents that do things possibly maybe not because of the goodness in their heart, but more for the financial reaping of the benefits. But when did a red light go off to you to realize that, you know what, there's something else involved here? There's something that looks kind of astray, because there seems like maybe there's an outside company or a subsidiary involved here that where crucial monies are not being allocated properly.
Right. Well, as I described, you know, first it was overwhelming to just see the individual difficulties that foster children were going through and all the circumstances that brought them into care and that they're encountering while in care. And then, you know, through my past advocacy and research, when I learned that the very state institutions, the foster care agencies that exist to protect their best interests, are actually taking resources from children who are either disabled or have deceased parents, red flags went off, to say the least, and I felt spurred to do more research and to understand what was happening and to try to help change things.
Explain some of those resources that were being taken.
Sure. So what's happening, and this is across the country, unfortunately, you have foster care agencies often at the state level, often entering into contracts with private revenue contractors. And they look for children who might have deceased parents, so they would be eligible for Social Security survivor benefits. They also look to maximize the number of children determined disabled, working with the same companies in order to claim disability benefits on behalf of the children, not to provide any additional resources whatsoever for those disabling conditions, but the states end up just taking the money as a state revenue source. Some states will even take more. Examples where states are taking veterans assistance benefits from children if their parents died in the military. About an example out of Nebraska, where the agency crafted a regulation, will even take a burial plot from a child if the child happens to have that in his or her assets.
Daniel, is this being conducted all on the up and up?
Well, I don't think so.
Much of this has happened
under the surface because people haven't known, like none of us really have known, and the kids have not been informed. So states are doing this. They don't tell the children when they apply for the benefits or when they apply to take over control of the money as representative payee, which is supposed to be a fiduciary obligation, right? They're supposed to only act in the best interest of the child. So I think there's illegality happening, which hasn't been fully hammered out in the courts yet across the country. I hope it is. I think it's a clear breach of fiduciary obligation when the states are engaged in this practice.
So this is coming to light, for example, if someone who turns 18, becomes an adult, wants to get services or monies that should be allocated to them, and they actually find out that this has been happening for a while.
Right. Yeah, so a lot of kids never know. And that's a great question, because for a child to bring a legal claim, in many states there's a shortened time frame to bring a claim against the state, a shorter statute of limitations, if you will. So if the kids don't even know this is happening, they don't have the ability to bring these claims often until it's too late. That happened to a former client of mine, a former foster child whose survivor benefits were taken, and he struggled ever since he left foster care with homelessness and unemployment, and the benefit could have been a huge assistance for him to plan for his transition out of care, and also I think for him having that emotional connection, right? You know, these survivor benefits occur because a parent worked and paid into the system and earned that benefit for a child. And to have that connection to a deceased parent so a child could use that money to help themselves, I think, could provide immense value.
What is a typical statute of limitations average time for a situation of this nature?
Well, an example, in Maryland, you'd have to bring the case within 1 year of when the claim arose.
That's ridiculous.
And in this litigation I was involved with on behalf of this former foster child, the state actually argued that the child should have brought that claim within 1 year of when they started taking the money from him, right? And so that would have happened when he was 12 in foster care, and they provided no notice at all at that time. So how could he have possibly even known in order to bring that claim? But they were successful on that argument, unfortunately. Now, another child, luckily, in Maryland that was represented by the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau, his case went up to the top appellate court in Maryland, and the court did find that the state was violating foster children's due process rights for not giving notice. So at least in Maryland, that issue has been addressed, but I hope Maryland and other states go much further and eventually find that a breach of fiduciary obligation is happening.
So it's completely designed not for the benefit of the consumers.
In this case, right. You know, and I should say, I think the frontline caseworkers want to do well, on average, very much want to do well for their clients, and they're often overworked and underpaid. So this is happening much higher up at the state levels, the secretaries of the Human Service Agency, sometimes, you know, beyond at the governor's office. And I think the state institutions in that case, they've lost track of their mission, right? You know, it should be serving the public welfare, and particularly for foster children, that's the sole reason these agencies exist, is to promote, to protect the best interests of children in their care, not to maximize revenue and to take the resources.
Now, this is happening at a state level. I mean, if the feds must be aware of this, and if they are, why aren't they cracking down more?
Various institutions at the federal level have not been aware as they should be, but that's increasing, and I very much hope that with increased awareness that change will come. And actually, I had a chance to discuss this issue at the Social Security Advisory Board. They had a day-long set of meetings last week, and there was some interest in this, so I'm hopeful that individuals both at the Social Security Administration level might be interested in fixing this at the agency level. And then there are some members of Congress who are starting to take interest. And actually, a bill was just introduced that I helped to work on with Congressman Danny Davis out of Illinois, which would protect foster children's benefits. So I'm hopeful that things will improve.
Is there a name to this bill yet, Daniel?
I don't have the name, actually, but it was just introduced last week, and it's by Congressman Danny Davis to look up. But it would protect both the disability and survivor benefits of foster children and spur a planning process, not just to conserve the children's funds, but to help use their funds to plan for their transition out of care. So it would be a wonderful change if that legislation is enacted.
Now, I'm sure survivor benefits can change and vastly differ from case to case, but we're talking about crucial benefits for a child that probably could last years and can really make a difference in their lives. And if it's not available to them, that is just a highway robbery.
I agree. And at such a crucial time period, right? You know, both when they're dealing with the difficulties in foster care and then foster children, unfortunately, are not doing well when they leave care. The stats are really lined up against them. Foster children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans.
Really?
As they're leaving care, many face homelessness. Alarming percentages become involved in the criminal justice system. So, you know, when these children are harmed and they lose the benefit of this resource that could help them, we're all harmed, and not just morally, although that's important to me, but we're harmed financially. We pay the cost as the children don't do well as they leave care.
My name is Mark Farrell. This is the Progressive Radio Network. The show is Insight. Daniel Hatcher is my guest. Daniel has written a new book called The Poverty Industry. And, Daniel, I have to ask you a question in terms of outside contractors or private contractors, which you write about. How susceptible and or culpable are they? Very?
Well, that's a great question. So many states now are increasing their use of revenue contractors to help with this process. And this is just one of the strategies that they use. They're also often will seek to maximize Medicaid funds from a variety of different populations, and sometimes states use that money well, and I think that's a very good thing, right, to get that aid, but then some states will divert those funds from intended purpose. With the issue of taking resources from foster children, you have states that enter these revenue contracts, and then the contractors will often take over much of the process to help, for example, increase the number of children determined disabled and take the case processes through the entire application process and appeal process in seeking the disability benefits, SSI benefits. And I've seen, I've sent out requests for documents and received several of contract documents, and there's very concerning language. You know, an assessment report, for example, I received out of Maryland, the contractor described children as a revenue-generating mechanism. So that's obviously concerning to me, but at the end of the day, I have to say, you know, it's the state leaders who are then deciding to divert those funds, right, to take those monies from the children. You know, so in Maryland, for example, they have a contract with a company by the name of Maximus. Maryland could do some good with that contract to help claim more much-needed aid funds on behalf of foster children, and then the state could have said, we're not going to take that money from the kids, but we're actually going to use the money to help the children as intended.
And explain, this is a great segue, explain how our beloved New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, has siphoned critical funds that you were just alluding to different general funds.
So Medicaid is another example, unfortunately, where sometimes the funds are diverted. And the process I discuss out of New Jersey is, again, using children for the process where the state works with a revenue contractor. It forces school districts to participate to try to maximize school-based Medicaid claims on behalf of poor disabled school children. And these are funds that are intended to help provide more special education services, more services for those disabling conditions, which is a huge need, right? You know, very important source
Absolutely.
Of aid. So that in itself is a good thing to get more aid. But then right in the Christie administration budget documents, they're diverting over 80% of those school-based Medicaid claims to general state coffers. And so literally the state is taking tens of millions of dollars annually from poor disabled school children. In the meantime, in New Jersey, there's been some reports that I've seen that schools are so underfunded that they've resorted to selling ads on the sides of school buses.
Absolutely. You see that everywhere. It's pretty commonplace. So how can this atrocity be rectified? How can it be allowed to be done? The reallocation of money.
Right. Well, again, I hope that awareness will spur change, right? You know, some of this has been happening, has been known to some, you know, individuals at the government level. Obviously, the states know what they're doing, and at the federal level, I hope that with us all becoming more aware that outrage will spur needed change, right? And some of the needed changes aren't really complicated, right? If you claim school-based Medicaid funds intended to help schools provide more services for those poor disabled children's conditions, that's the way the money should be used, right? It's not intended to become a means of shoring up state budget shortfalls generally. And what you see is you have states that are across the country, red states and blue states, are cash-strapped, have been unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation, so they're looking for money elsewhere. You know, we've reached a point where, again, foster care agencies are even taking resources from children in their own care.
It's just abysmal. I can't kind of wrap my head around this. When your book came across my desk, I was just dumbfounded that in this day and age, especially since, well, you would think there's a lot of transparency that this could go on, but it's happening.
It is, and transparency is one of the great difficulties here in terms of following the money, right? And that state by state, that varies a lot in terms of the budget processes. Some are more transparent than others. Some are more easy to understand where the money is going than others. And then in many states, much of this is happening at the county level, which can make it even more difficult to follow the money. And sometimes it is a matter of capacity, where if you have an agency, federal agency, that's aware and is trying to clamp down, say, on some of the Medicaid diversion strategies, just simply having the capacity to monitor that is a great difficulty. So there is a significant need to increase that capacity to monitor and make sure funds are used as intended. I can say also, I mean, this goes towards, there's some proposals out there that have been from, including from Ryan, and even Trump on his website wants to block grant the Medicaid program. And I think the book provides very strong evidence that such a block grant is a horrible idea. You know, the idea of a block grant is essentially it would give all the money to states to simply do what they want and say, please help the poor, right? So if you have a governor right now who under a complex regulatory structure is using budget shell games and moving money around and diverting aid from intended purpose, what's that governor going to do if he or she is just given a blank check like that, right? It would result in much greater waste and misuse of the aid and much less aid funds getting to those who truly need it.
We're basically dealing with discretion, and we know what happens when politicians have discretion.
Well, and you get down to the state level and even the more local levels, again, because these state governments and the county governments are so cash-strapped that they're more likely to take those funds
and they
use
may
them
have,
for unintended purposes.
They may have good intentions to have other money earmarked to replenish it, but a lot of times that's not the reality, I imagine.
Often that's correct, right.
Do me a favor, Daniel Hatcher, explain Title 4E.
Sure. So Title 4E of the Social Security Act is the main funding stream from the federal government to states to provide foster care assistance. And it's a matching grant program, actually, much like the Medicaid program. So states are supposed to spend some of their own funds, and they receive federal aid matches from the federal government. So this is another source of funds that is available and intended by the states to pay for the cost of foster care. And it's unfortunate you already have this source of funds, and some states are still taking other resources from kids in their care, right? But there's concerning structures within Title 4E. One of the greatest concerns with the structure the way it's set up is that states are only able to claim that federal aid, the Title 4E funds, to help provide foster care services if they take a child from poor families, right? You know, so really concerning financial incentives that are built into the system that need to be addressed.
Now, trying to address consumers, and this is a kind of a macro question, but how do you know going into trying to get money or services that you're entitled to? Obviously, your book is going to be a great, helpful tool, indispensable tool, the poverty industry. But what advice can you give people in terms of whether helping a foster family out, foster child, death benefits, et cetera? And I imagine this varies from state to state level. What's the proper way to investigate what one is entitled to?
Sure, and like as you indicated, that does vary state by state in determining the type of benefit we're discussing. But if we consider foster children, say survivor benefits or disability benefits, if there's a parent involved or a relative who's trying to help that child, in each state first, a foster child should have an advocate, either an attorney or a guardian ad litem, appointed to help that child. And if the family member or interested relative or whoever's trying to assist can figure out the identity of that individual and reach out to that advocate, that would be a great way to start to then help find out what's happening and if the child is receiving such a resource, right? Sometimes the child themselves might have an ability to find out from a social worker if the child is old enough, and also finding out the direct social worker involved is sometimes a great resource to try to find this information out. And then if the individual can determine that if a child is getting these benefits and if the state is taking the money, there are ways where the child and other individuals can apply to have a different representative payee appointed, somebody else to manage the child's funds. And that individual could do what's right, you know, if they, you know, take control over the money and then actually use the child's money as intended to help the child.
Do you think that these outside private contractors are exactly that because it looks better if something they can be the fall guy and the finger pointing can happen their way versus a state or a local town level?
Well, the states are still actually acting as representative payee when they're working with the contractors. Mm-hmm. The contractors are helping in the whole process of claiming the aid, and then the contractors actually often will help the states become representative payee to take over control of the funds. But then it is the state who's supposed to be deciding, you know, how to use that money. I think what's happening a lot of times with the revenue contractors is often the states either don't have the capacity, like the amount of personnel to go through this process of seeking to increase claims on behalf of foster children, so they're hiring the revenue contractors to help. Often, too, many of the revenue contractors in the past have encouraged states and state agencies to do this because they'll do it in a way that doesn't cost the state or the state agency any money unless funds are claimed, right? And then through the payment, essentially the contractor will take a cut of the aid funds that are claimed on behalf of the children.
Do you think that they're actually vital and needed?
The
contractors?
The aid funds or
the contractors?
The contractors.
Correct. The contractors, I'm sorry.
The contractors, in some states, I think they could do some real good if the states don't have the capacity to do this. And some of the contractors have developed, you know, expertise in this practice. I wish it was done in a way that didn't take any of the aid funds at all from the children, right? And certainly not the state shouldn't be taking in all the money for state coffers. But it could provide some assistance to increase these funds claimed on behalf of children if the states would just stop taking the money. I know there are many states who do this on their own, so it's not crucial that they work with the contractors. And I think that has been part of the problem mm-hmm. in terms of that shift in focus towards revenue maximization rather than maximizing the public good. But again, at the end of the day, I think the responsibility lies with the state leaders.
What you mentioned a few minutes ago about the statute of limitations in terms of anyone going back to claim what truthfully is theirs or what they thought was theirs, and most likely I'm sure it turns out to be was theirs, the one-year approximate timeline seems incredibly short. Is there any states that have actually extended it? Is there any way with this, with your book coming out, that maybe this could be a first step that at least the media could get honest and say, okay, listen, there's – first of all, to reform, to implement the new reform that's needed, and it's obviously going to fluctuate from state to state and level to level. But maybe the first thing we should do is back up the statute of limits times to maybe 3 to 5 years, so at least we can get things in place, and then if there's some action that needs to be any recourse, there's ample time.
I think those are great questions, and there could be certainly, you know, across the states a look at the current policies regarding these statute of limitations, especially if you're dealing with a vulnerable population, you know, like foster children, or you think of the elderly in nursing homes, you know, that to give them the real access that's needed in order to bring claims if there are viable claims, right? You know, and so I think that would be of great assistance. I hope that as more advocates, more attorneys, other individuals become aware of this practice that more claims can be brought on behalf of foster children to truly help them. And again, some of this, you know, you could have an affirmative claim that's potentially brought if a state is taking funds from children, and there also could be an effort to change who's in control of the money, right? So let's say if a grandparent becomes aware of this for a foster child, that grandparent could try to help apply to become representative payee themselves, right, you know, on behalf of a foster child, and then they could truly use those funds on behalf of the child's best interest as intended.
Of course, you spent, I imagine, a year or two writing this, correct?
It was a few years in writing the book. Some of the research, much of the research goes back much further. Some of the issues I've been digging into and working on for quite a while, and these practices, unfortunately, have been happening for a long time. So sometimes change is slow, but I'm hopeful that change is possible once we all increase our awareness of what's occurring.
So I imagine it must have been equally rewarding to write this, but also very, very frustrating because, yes, you have a great deal of experience in this area, but the more you dug, the more you found out was not benefiting the people that it's been designed for.
That's a good way to describe it, and it does feel rewarding to me to help increase awareness of practices that are harming vulnerable populations, but I'm also greatly frustrated and horrified, you know, by practices that are hurting the most vulnerable among us. I mean, we're all connected, right? You know, how a foster child is impacted, as I was describing before, impacts all of us. And I hope that we can remember that again, you know, so like as we become aware of these practices that we want to help these individuals, and as they do better, we all do better.
Now, as a professor, certainly you're imparting some great information to students at a phenomenal institution. But does this ever, and I don't want to put you in an awkward position, ever make you consider to get involved in politics because of a nature of this that happens?
I haven't considered getting involved in politics, but I very much want to do whatever I can to help improve these policies and other policies and practices that are not serving vulnerable populations well. And that's a significant reason why I transitioned from being a legal aid lawyer and doing other advocacy work to becoming a law professor, where I still teach a clinic, and I have the honor of helping law students learn by helping low-income clients. And I think that grounding and frontline advocacy along with doing policy work is crucial. But making the shift to becoming a law professor at the University of Baltimore helped me to expand my advocacy and to be able to do more writing. So I want to do all that I can to help.
Daniel, if there was a magic wand that could be waved to remedy this in a sort of a realistic way, how do you think that could be done?
Well, it's issue by issue, so that's a hard question.
It is.
Just take the issue with foster children's resources, the fastest magic wand would be happening either at the federal agency level or through legislation simply to prohibit states from taking these funds from children, right? There's actually right now a wonderful savings vehicle that has been created by Congress within the last year or two. It was called the ABLE Act that allows children's disability benefits to be conserved in what are called 529A plans, which are like college savings plans, but expanded, where they can also be used for other needs for the child based upon their disabilities and their transition to independence. Those could be available. They should be available for foster children. We just need to stop states from taking the money.
And absolutely, going back to the disabled portion that you just mentioned, that's crucial time because a lot of times after high school or their special needs programs end, a lot of young adults with disabilities are clueless and don't really have anywhere to go.
That's right. There's unfortunately not a good sort of transition of benefits and assistance for youth as they become adults, and that is a crucial time, both for kids aging out of foster care and other children who are struggling with disabilities and other difficulties to make that transition.
The Poverty Industry is available everywhere. And who's the publisher, Daniel?
NYU Press, and it's available on their website as well.
And do you have a website?
I have a faculty website profile. If you just look up my name, Daniel Hatcher, at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And I have more information both about the book there and other research that I've written and advocacy I've done over the years.
Daniel Hatcher, a great deal of thanks for really putting a lot of time and dedication into an area that really needs to be focused and addressed, because this is obviously such a macro situation. It's probably affecting close to probably hundreds of thousands of people, correct?
It is, unfortunately, affecting hundreds of thousands, you know, again, the practices with foster children and the other Medicaid diversion strategies. And with Medicaid, I mean, the amount of money, we're talking billions of dollars that are being diverted from those who need the assistance.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Daniel. Thank you so much for all your work.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Good day to you. My name is Mark Farrell. The show has been Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Noel is up next, and he has an incredible show planned for you. What? I have no idea, but he's always very witty, and he imparts some great information. If you ever want me to speak at your college, school, organization, etc., check out MarkFarrellMotivation.com, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Of course, this program and all the Insight shows are available on PRN.FM. Have a great day!